A hedge fund manager visits a Tanzanian orphanage and returns home to create a charity stock-picking game. A tech billionaire believes making workers 5% faster will solve inequality. A pharmaceutical dynasty donates millions to museums while their company fuels an addiction crisis. What connects these stories? They're all examples of how the world's most powerful people have rebranded themselves as our rescuers while quietly maintaining the very systems that require rescuing in the first place. This isn't about bad intentions. It's about something far more insidious, a new ruling class that has convinced itself, and much of society, that the market can solve problems the market created. Since 1980, something remarkable and disturbing has happened in America. The income of the top 0.001% has increased sevenfold. Meanwhile, the bottom half of Americans have seen virtually no growth. The American dream now operates on a split screen, 70% achievable if you're born wealthy, just 35% if you're born poor. Rich American men now outlive their poor counterparts by 15 years, as if wealth and poverty have become different countries with different life expectancies. As this chasm widened, a curious transformation occurred. The billionaires, consultants, and financiers who benefited most from this system began positioning themselves not as beneficiaries, but as uniquely qualified problem solvers. They created what we might call Market World, an ecosystem of conferences, foundations, and initiatives where powerful people gather to discuss changing the world through business-friendly solutions that never threaten their own positions. Previous generations spoke of fighting the system or challenging the man. Today's elite changemakers speak instead of disruption, innovation, and impact, language that casts them not as part of the problem, but as heroic entrepreneurs of social good. When Hillary Cohen graduated from Georgetown in 2014, McKinsey promised she could use business training to change the world at scale. Georgetown reinforced this as business language conquered social change, displacing older vocabularies of power, justice, and rights. At McKinsey, Cohen saw through the mythology. The famed problem-solving processes weren't generating solutions. Teams figured out answers through common sense, then backfilled them into templates. Yet other domains desperately sought business thinking, with even the White House relying heavily on consultants and financiers implicated in many public problems. At Market World's heart lies an irresistible concept: do well and do good simultaneously, profit while solving social problems, change the world without threatening anyone's position. This win-win ideology evolved from Adam Smith's invisible hand into something more audacious, the belief that business leaders can intentionally solve social problems better than governments or charities. Consider Stacey Asher, who after an African epiphany at a Tanzanian orphanage, created a fantasy football-style stock competition directing proceeds to charities, without examining how her finance industry might be implicated in Tanzania's problems. Or Justin Rosenstein, whose collaboration software he believes improves humanity by making everyone 5% faster, overlooking that while American productivity grew 72% between 1973 and 2014, median wages rose only 9%. The limitations become starkest with Even, an app charging working-class Americans $260 annually to smooth erratic incomes, treating symptoms rather than addressing underlying causes like outsourcing and stagnant wages. The Venn diagram approach raises a crucial question: what happens to interests falling outside the overlap between profit and social good? At Davos and TED, tech billionaires position themselves as rebels fighting corrupt systems, never as establishment figures. When Uber and Lyft faced lawsuits from drivers seeking employee status, both claimed to be mere technology platforms. Judge Edward Chen demolished this. Uber is no more a technology company than Yellow Cab is because it uses CB radios. Silicon Valley insists technology levels power divides. Mark Zuckerberg promotes internet connectivity as providing education and healthcare to the disadvantaged. Mark Andreessen claims Airbnb reduces income inequality. Yet networks simultaneously democratize and concentrate power. While platforms enable anyone to publish or monetize assets, the Frightful Five, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, control foundational platforms forming a gilded mesh blanketing the entire economy. Tech elites like Peter Thiel fantasize about rule-free zones, seasteading communities, or safe places for technological experimentation. This anarchist cheerleading sounds revolutionary, but serves the powerful. As feminist Joe Freeman noted, structurelessness becomes a smokescreen for the strong or the lucky to establish unquestioned hegemony. Tech elites have overturned the Enlightenment project of universal rules, creating digital manners ruled by the Earl of Facebook and Lord of Google, all while denying their power through language of community and love. When Harvard psychologist Amy Cuddy gave her first talk outside academia, she chose to focus on power posing, a way to boost confidence through body language, rather than her research on systemic power and discrimination. She gave Market World exactly what it craved, framing power problems to help the powerless without challenging those who held power. This illustrates the distinction between public intellectuals, critics who challenge power, and thought leaders, optimistic, true believers who know one big thing and go easy on the powerful. The Market World circuit rewards those who know how to be hearable, focus on victims rather than perpetrators, personalize the political, and be constructively actionable by offering solutions rather than criticism. Pulitzer-winning journalist Charles Duhigg exemplifies this shift, pivoting from exposing corporate wrongdoing to solution-oriented topics like habit formation. Cuddy's cruel paradox: when she abandoned systemic change for individual empowerment, she began receiving constant validation from women thanking her for changing their lives, unlike critical scholars who rarely heard their work made a difference. When George Soros's Open Society Foundations launched their economic advancement program, they hired Sean Hinton, a McKinsey and Goldman Sachs alumnus, to lead it. Hinton assembled Market World experts, private equity executives, former investment bankers, management consultants. Their approach to justice came through PowerPoint slides where the human reality all but vanished. Before his corporate career, Hinton studied ethnomusicology in Mongolia, where success meant hanging back, observing, realizing all he didn't know. At McKinsey, he learned to have a day one hypothesis, even in unfamiliar industries, a strange kind of earned presumptuousness. These protocols now promote theories suggesting people are poorer because they lack linkages, not because of structural issues like caste, race, or resource hoarding. Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation, challenged wealthy philanthropists to examine how they make money, not just how they give it away. He invoked Martin Luther King Jr.'s call to examine the circumstances of economic injustice which make philanthropy necessary. The Sacklers exemplified this hypocrisy. Their company sparked an opioid epidemic, killing hundreds of thousands, yet Market World embraced their philanthropy while ignoring the harm. By 2016, at the final Clinton Global Initiative, elites anxiously debated, "Why do they hate us?" Panels featured exclusively globalist voices discussing populist backlash, consistently framing populist anger as irrational while refusing to acknowledge legitimate grievances. Queen Rania of Jordan lamented that leaders were consumed by very urgent issues like votes and short-term politics, revealing globalism's fundamentally anti-democratic streak. The inescapable conclusion? We must go somewhere other than where we have been going, led by people other than those who have been leading us. Philosopher Chiara Cordelli offers a bracing critique. Elites refuse to ask why so many need help or whether their own actions contributed to these problems. By solving problems within a broken system while remaining silent about that system, they resemble kind-hearted slave masters who treat their slaves well while refusing to challenge slavery itself. Cordelli offers a way out. Acknowledge you are debtors who need society's mercy, not saviors who need its followership. Return to politics as the place to shape the world. When society solves problems politically and systemically, it speaks on behalf of every citizen, a right illegitimate when exercised by private individuals. Our political institutions, laws, courts, elected officials, agencies, rights, constitutions, regulations, taxes, shared infrastructure are what can act and speak on behalf of everyone. While these institutions often fall short, the answer isn't to abandon them. It's our job to make them better. The culture rewards those who make the powerful comfortable while offering the powerless, navigable personal solutions. Protocol bearers rush to solve problems their methods helped create, imposing a winner's perspective that displaces more humble approaches. Those who benefit most from an unjust system position themselves as uniquely qualified to fix it, ensuring their solutions never threaten the arrangements that elevated them. The choice is clear: democracy or aristocracy dressed as innovation. Real change requires not thought leaders with beautiful solutions, but citizens willing to do the messy work of self-governance.